Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the NBA Podcast. We have a great episode for you today. We're going to talk about Game 1 of the 2017 NBA Finals, kind of the big takeaways from that, the adjustments we'd like to see made heading into Game 2, and then we're going to have a lot of NBA draft banter as well. Before we get underway, just a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find all of our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can find us on iTunes. We'd love it if you'd subscribe, download, left some feedback. We'd love any reviews you have. And we're being hosted this year on FanRag Sports, so check them out on Twitter, at FanRag Sports, and for their NBA content, at FanRag NBA. Lots of good finals coverage, as usual. Also, the off-season, free agency, the draft, a lot of that stuff starting to roll out, so there's going to be a lot of good NBA content, even after the finals are over. Check them out, FanRag Sports. Today, joining me, as always, is my co-host, Morten Jensen. How's it going, Mort?
It's going well, Brian.
And we also have a special guest, Derek Bodner, basically the Zach Lowe of Philadelphia sports writers. How's it going, Derek? Thanks for joining us.
It's going great. My pleasure.
So, Derek, before we get underway, just let our listeners know where they can find your work.
Well, it's at a few places. Easiest way is just Twitter, at Derek Bodner NBA. I have my own kind of Sixers coverage thing, then I do some stuff for Draft Express and The Ringer and whatnot, so easiest way to get all that is through Twitter.
Yes. All right. Yeah. Definitely give Derek a follow. He is, even if you're not a Sixers fan, he's one of the best NBA writers out there today. And you will learn a lot reading his stuff. So we're going to start talking with game one of the finals. We're recording this on Friday, so game one was last night. Started off, you know, people going into the series were hoping it was going to be a good series and hoping it was going to be competitive. And for the first quarter and a half or so, it was. And then the Warriors just went full flying death machine. They win 113-91. Kevin Durant has 38 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists. Steph Curry, 28 points, 10 assists, 6 rebounds. The Cavs' big three actually played pretty well. It's just the rest of the team didn't show up. So, Derek, what were the big takeaways that you saw from Game 1?
Well, I think the first takeaway is, holy crap, Golden State's really good. And that shouldn't surprise anyone for a team that it seems like they sleptwalk through 67 wins. But, I mean, when you talk about, you know, the Cavs kind of dialing it up for the playoffs, and if you're an Eastern Conference team and you look at that and you go, man, I don't know how we're ever going to beat, even at his age, I don't know how we're ever going to beat LeBron. And then you realize you have to ratchet it up another level even after accomplishing that Herculean feat to beat Golden State. I mean, this is an 80s era juggernaut, and this might be one of the best, if not the best, rosters of all time in a salary capped age. And the way that they can space the floor and move the ball and force turnovers and get out in transition and D it up and switch everything, it's just there's so many things that have to go wrong for you to win a game, much less four games in a series. It's just, it's incredible to watch. And I think we all realize that throughout their, you know, 67 win season. And the fact that this team has lost one game since mid-March. That's absurd. That's 2001 Lakers level dominance. But to then see them go and pick apart the Cavs like that, it was really impressive. And look, Cleveland's not going to be, when they're negative 14 in the turnover battle, they're just not going to have a chance against this team. And they have to be able to get themselves out in transition. They have to, you know, be able to attack that defense before it's set and get some mismatches, or they're going to end up with a lot of isolation attempts like they had last night. And that's just not a recipe against a team that's as talented as Golden State is.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, the big fear coming in to the playoffs, frankly, was can the Cavaliers' defense, you know, it was mediocre a lot during the regular season. They toughened up during the playoffs, but then the Warriors just, I mean, it was a layup line most of the night. Like, how many uncontested dunks did Kevin Durant have last night? It felt like all. It was just, that was brutal. I'm glad you mentioned the turnovers. I mean, it was 20 for Cleveland, 4 for Golden State. I think I saw this on Twitter that it was an NBA Finals record for the fewest number of turnovers, also a Warriors franchise record, regular season or playoffs, fewest number of turnovers. I mean, Mort, when we previewed the series, we mentioned their turnover issues because that was, you know, if this Warriors team has a weak link, it's that, is that they can get careless with the ball occasionally. So that did not happen at all during game one. No. So What do you think Cleveland can do, if anything, to narrow that margin?
No, that, I think it's they really have to just keep the ball moving, honestly. As Derek alluded to before, when you have a whole lot of isolation basketball, is that the offense becomes somewhat easy to identify and you can make the proper reads and corrections. The ball needs to just move and move and move, and LeBron just was in isolation mode. He had to be on some level when the bench didn't show up. So I don't expect this huge margin in game two. But look, four turnovers for Golden State, like, that is ridiculous. If they're playing at that level, there's nothing you can't do, Brian.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. If, you know, if they're as a team, it's just, it's unfathomable. You know, LeBron had 7 turnovers in the first half alone. Like, for Golden State to finish an entire game with 4 turnovers, especially given how careless they could be at times, it was just surreal. I mean, so yeah, I think if you're Cleveland, you kind of just have to hope for regression to the mean for both you and them. Derek, do you have any other ideas for what Cleveland could do to kind of narrow that gap?
Well, I mean, I think regression is a very likely thing to rely on, too. Like, there's no way a team that struggled that much in terms of taking care of the ball, I think they were 22nd in turnover percentage. That's not really a performance you can reproduce with any kind of consistency, and that will help Cleveland quite a bit. But I think one of the big differences this year with Golden State versus last year, you know, LeBron, especially when KD gets hot like that at the beginning of the game, he has to then go and try to slow down KD. And I think not only does that, you know, sap some of his energy offensively, but that also doesn't allow him to play that free safety kind of role defensively that, you know, that they really rely on to force turnovers, to create transition opportunities, and to really kind of get them going. And I think just having a team like this where he really can't, there's no one you can slide LeBron James onto and kind of let him play that free safety role. I think that's going to be a big key in this series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the hope was that maybe you could do it with Andre Iguodala because he had been pretty cold from the field heading into the playoffs, or into the finals, I should say. I mean, he didn't do much in game one, 7 points on 3 of 4 shooting, but he did hit his only 3-pointer. So, you know, if Iggy's hitting, it's over. And, you know, the concern was Iggy missed a couple games during the Western Conference Finals. His knee, you know, we weren't sure how his knee would hold up. Seemed like he was moving pretty well last night. I mean, one of the other things that's worth noting, you know, KD had 38, Steph Curry had 28. No other Warriors players scored more than 9 points. You know, Draymond Green was 3 of 12. Klay Thompson remains ice cold, 3 of 16 from the field, 0 of 5 from 3, 6 points on the night. So even still, I saw this stat on Twitter from Dieter Kurtenbach of Fox Sports. Apparently, Klay, when he was the primary defender, the Cavs went 1 of 12. So he's still making a positive impact, even though he is just, you know, in this awful slump. Derek, do you have any ideas of, you know, what the Warriors can do to get Klay going, or do they even need to?
Well, I think they're going to need to at some point. Like, you're not going to have that turnover differential. You're not going to always have KD going off like that, although, you know, these guys have talent levels where you could, it's not as crazy as it sounds. You know, I think right now Klay is just in one of those slumps, and he goes through that from time to time. Like you said, at the very least, he is such a good defensive player, and I think he's really, you know, I think he really gets credit for that now, whereas maybe earlier in his career he didn't. He's at least giving you some value. But yeah, I mean, they need to get him going. I'm not exactly sure what the answer is. I mean, he got decent looks. He's had decent looks throughout these playoffs. They just haven't been falling. So it probably has more to do with, you know, with Klay and his preparation and him kind of fighting through this for himself. But yeah, I mean, he hasn't really had a great game now in quite some time. And there's only maybe one or two games, specifically in Portland. I think he blew up in one of those games. But we really haven't seen typical Klay in quite some time, and that's a little bit concerning. But if there's any team that can come over a guy or overcome a guy like Klay going through a slump, it's this team.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, it's crazy that they can win by 22 points, and, you know, their third and fourth best guys in Dre and Klay combined for, what, like 15 points? I mean, it's...
Yeah.
If you're so, here's the overall question, I guess. I mean, Mort, you and Sarah were more optimistic than I was that this was going to be a real series. If you're a Cavs fan, what consolation do you take from this game? Are there any major adjustments you'd like to see them make going into game two? And do you think, I mean, is this thing over after one game, or is there still a chance that Cleveland, you know, bounces back from this, is more competitive in game two?
Well, I had a feeling you were going to ask me that. And look, last year they blew a 3-1 lead, so I'm not going to at any point say that this series is over because we saw what happened. But the only thing they can really hope to do is kind of cut off KD's legs, right? At this right. point, there's really not any other opportunity. I mean, you'd have to get Cleveland's bench really fired up because that was a huge problem. Like, the two leading minute players, Deron Williams and Kyle Korver, went scoreless. Mm. You can't have that. And then when you have J.R. Smith playing 28 minutes and finishing with 3 points, that's not helping. Tristan Thompson also, you know, an over in 22 minutes. So the supporting cast can't really play any worse than they did. So I guess on some level, that's encouraging. But there's no major positive takeaway from game one at all. I mean, I am nervous as hell if I'm a Cleveland fan.
Yeah, I mean, your only takeaway is that you have LeBron James.
Right.
That's right. Really, he's going to steal you a game or two. You hope it's early enough in the season or early enough in the series where it can maybe swing a tide. But, yeah, I mean, they're fighting an uphill battle. And like you said, Deron Williams, that was one of the worst performances I've seen in quite some time. They need something from their bench. They don't have the depth that a team like Golden State obviously has. Nobody does. But they need more. They need more from that because, like you said, LeBron had a good game. Kyrie wasn't necessarily the most efficient version of himself, but he gave you something. Kevin Love at least contributed on the glass, even if he struggled from the field. But they need something from their bench, and last night they just didn't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Kevin Love, you know, we haven't mentioned him yet. 15 points, 21 rebounds, 3 blocks. I mean, compared to last finals Kevin Love, where he was just a shell of himself for most of the series, you know, that's... if he's getting 20 boards a game, that's all the Cavs can reasonably ask of him. I will say... I mean, if I'm Cleveland, you know, they were talking last night after the game about how you practice, but until you actually see the Warriors and their speed, you don't have a sense for how fast they are. So I feel like maybe if you're a Cleveland fan, that's your one hope, is that, like, they woke up and now, you know, Friday morning, they're like, oh, man, we really, you know, we're facing a juggernaut. We can't be sloppy with the ball, or they're going to hit a three on us or run the floor in transition. It's a guaranteed 2 points. Their switch defense, you know, maybe they rethink how they do that. I will say, I mean, there is one play in particular that stands out where Kevin Love gets switched on to Kevin Durant, and Durant just looked like a serial killer. Like, he immediately drove to the baseline, right to the basket, right past Kevin Love. So if I'm Cleveland, I'm doing everything in my power to make sure Kevin Love never, ever has to defend KD, because there's no, you know, he's not quick enough laterally to keep up with him, but you can't just have Kevin Love hang at the basket, because then KD's just going to be wide open and hit that jumper. So that's one, you know, I don't know how you make that adjustment in a 3-day stretch, or if you do, maybe you just live with those points, but, you know, I think clearly somehow slowing down Kevin Durant is the number one focus coming into Sunday. Derek, any final takeaways before we hop over to the draft?
No, I mean, I'm just, I'm in awe watching this team, and it's kind of a shame. My rooting interest in this series is which narrative do I think would be less painful to go through, which narrative would be less annoying. So it's, do I want to hear about KD, you know, not even be able to win on the Warriors, or do I want to hear about LeBron blowing another finals appearance? And I'm not sure exactly where my rooting interest is because of that, but I mean, this is just, it's incredible to watch. It really is. And we're going to look back on this team in 20 years, and it's probably still going to be just as incredible.
Yeah. I think, you know, SB Nation had a piece yesterday about, it was like a round table where they asked a lot of their writers, like, are the Warriors fun? Do you enjoy watching them? And a couple of them said yes, but most of them were like torn or no. Which I think you're right. You know, in 20 years, we're going to look back and we're like, how did you not enjoy this team? This team's insane. Like, you can't build a team this good on NBA 2K, even when you turn trades off. I will say, I work with a lot of Bay Area fans, so for that reason, I would really enjoy the Warriors to collapse again. But I just don't see it happening. What about you, Mort? Any final takeaways?
I just want more Rihanna.
Yeah, she was the star of game one. I can't believe we're 15 minutes in. We did not mention Rihanna.
I mean, yeah. rather talk about Rihanna than LeVar Ball, right?
I mean, yeah, I guess we need to... Well, we'll get to LeVar shortly. But yes, this will be the one and only time we discuss LeVar Ball on this podcast. All right, so let's move over to the draft. Derek, as you mentioned at the top of the show, also writes for Draft Express, does great work with them, so he's... very familiar, has been poring over these prospects for months, which is great, you know, not only as a fellow Sixers aficionado, but also just as league-wide expertise. So we're going to start right at the top. Number one pick, Boston's on the clock. Derek, what makes Markelle Fultz the clear-cut number one pick in this draft?
I mean, just about everything. Like, he has almost everything you can want for out of a point guard prospect in this day and age. And obviously the one big negative is his defense. And look, it wasn't there at UW, and that was a team that defense just wasn't there. But he, at least at the very least, he has tools to overcome that. Like, you could see a path where he becomes a pretty good defender. I think you look through some of his, you know, high school shoe camp and U18s and whatnots, and he had some moments where he played some good defense, moments when he wasn't carrying quite the same offensive burden. So I really think he could become a really good all-around player. You know, I think what he excels at in terms of a point guard prospect is just the, you know, his balance, his coordination, his body control, his touch, his diversity of moves. Like, he has every move in the book. He has every spin move and step back and hesitation move you could want from a guy. And you combine that with, you know, 6'4 size, good athleticism, really great body control in the paint, and I think probably underrated passing and court vision. You know, he just has he checks a lot of boxes, and I think in a draft where once you get past him, you have to really figure out which weaknesses you're willing to overlook, which strengths are more important to you than others, and how that fits into your team concept and your team talent. He's the one guy where you could pick him up, drop him onto pretty much any team, onto pretty much any system, and I think he's diverse enough that he is going to fit. So I think that's why he's a number one pick. I think his scoring translates at a it's really easy to make that projection. His combination of shooting, and like I said, his moves and his athleticism and his coordination and his balance and his body control, it's a very unique package.
Well, now I'm even more devastated that the Sixers did not get the number one pick. Yeah, so, yeah, thank you for that. Okay, well, so Morton here is I don't even know if it's right to call you a Chicago Bulls fan anymore, Mort, but once...
You damn well know it's not.
Once was a Chicago Bulls fan and has been trying to trade Jimmy Butler for years now. So, Derek, if you're Boston, are you willing to move that pick at all? Is there any offer, aside from, like, you know, an absolutely ridiculous, you could have a full team kind of offer, like a completely lopsided Vlade Divac kind of thing. Any reasonable offer that you're weighing for that pick, or if you're Boston, do you say, you know, just no, we're taking him, he's our point guard of the future?
The only time Vlade Divac and reasonable will be used in the same sentence. Right. I mean, you guys watched that game last night. Do you think Jimmy Butler makes Boston a real contender?
No.
I don't think he does. I think there's enough separation, certainly with the Warriors, but possibly with the even with LeBron and the Cavs. I don't know if that makes him a true... And look, you can't play scared. Like, I do think one thing, you know, so many people are writing off the next 3 to 4 years. And look, Cleveland's an injury away from there being a real opportunity. Maybe Golden State, they're 2 or 3 injuries away from there being a real opportunity. But there's, you know, you can't play scared like that. You can't build your team scared like that. But when you're talking about a talent like Markelle Fultz, and the guy who can really be the face of your franchise for a decade, I don't think Boston's going to be good enough if they trade that number one pick to really seriously contend, not for 50, 55 wins, not for a top two seed, but I mean for a title. I don't know if Jimmy Butler gets them there. My natural inclination would probably be take Markelle Fultz, ship off some of these other guards that are still valuable. They still have enough left on the contract. You can get something for them and build that way. That would be how I would go, especially because they still have another Brooklyn pick in their back pocket.
Right. Yeah, and we've talked about this more on our last episode where we recapped, you know, what's next for Boston. And we kind of landed at that same consensus where it's like, if you are not blown away by a completely lopsided offer, I mean, you get 9 years of Markelle Fultz. You know, it's hard to turn down, especially for Paul George, you know, who is by all accounts heading to L.A. in 2018, hell or high water. Or even Jimmy Butler, you know, it's 2 years of him. But, Derek, I'm with you. I don't think, you know, especially against the Warriors, I don't think the Celtics are one Jimmy Butler away from beating this Warriors team. So I think you're right that you can't build scared. And, you know, we saw Kevin Durant, you know, it seemed like at the end of February he broke his tibia and was out for the year. And that would have tilted the balance. So it's, you know, it's not to say the Celtics couldn't win, but it wouldn't be the most likely scenario. And is it worth sacrificing 9 years of Markelle Fultz? I don't know. So let's move on to the Lakers at number two. They face, you know, we're going to assume Markelle Fultz goes one, whether Boston keeps that pick or trades it. Lakers are on the board at two. LaVar Ball has been visualizing his son in a Lakers uniform probably since the day he was born. If you're the Lakers, do you make LaVar happy or do you go somewhere else?
You know, I do think if there's one team where De'Aaron Fox might fit really well, I think it could be the Lakers. That being said, I think there's a big enough talent gap where I would still go Lonzo Ball.
Mm.
And I think there's enough concern with De'Aaron Fox's jump shot that I'm not ready to put him up that high in the draft. So yes, I think they should probably go Lonzo Ball. I do think they will do their due diligence. I do think they should consider De'Aaron Fox. But to me, the second best talent in this draft is Lonzo Ball. And the only way I would, you know, yes, I think they should go Lonzo Ball.
Okay. So, you know, there was talk, I think the night of the draft lottery when they won the number two pick, Jake Fisher, fellow Philly guy who writes for Sports Illustrated, reported that multiple teams were already weighing offers for D'Angelo Russell. Do you think Lonzo and D'Angelo can coexist together? Or if they choose Lonzo, you know, should the Lakers consider trading Russell?
Well, I think offensively they can fit. I think Lonzo pushing the ball like he does will help pretty much any guard prospect, especially one who can shoot. And I think Lonzo plays enough off the ball where you can pair him with a second point guard offensively. I think the question is going to come in defensively. And having two guys like that who really struggle defending their man and fighting through screens would be tough to overcome. You know, I don't think Lonzo Ball is a complete non-contributor defensively. I think he does have really good instincts off the ball. I think he can really jump passing lanes. I think he can pinch down and hit rollers when he needs to. I think he generally makes pretty good decisions defensively, but he just doesn't have the lateral foot speed to really be an elite defender or maybe even a good or solid defender, and he gets blown up by screens too frequently. And I think having both of them there could be really tough to overcome. But the question comes down to what are you really going to get for D'Angelo Russell? And yeah, there's reports out there, but a lot of it's going to really come down to the details of that trade and what's being offered. Because if it's low, then I think you give it a shot and you see if maybe Lonzo's off the ball defense is enough where you can get by putting him on twos and maybe even in, you know, non-scoring option threes and kind of hide him that way. Because I think if you can allow him to play that kind of free safety role, and I think he has the size to have some versatility in that regard, you can hide him a little bit defensively. So unless the offers are good, I would see if it works out. I certainly think that would be a situation where D'Angelo Russell could put up some numbers offensively to keep his trade value high if it doesn't work out. So I wouldn't necessarily feel pressure to do it right now. But if there's a good offer, then yeah, I do think you have to consider it, because I do think defensively that would be it would be tough to build a really good defense with those two guys on the perimeter.
Yeah, that does seem to be the primary concern. Offensively, I think both of those guys, at least, you know, we've seen it with the Warriors. Like, you can have multiple guys handle the ball. Like, Draymond Green is often the leading assist guy for the Warriors, and it's fine. You know, D'Angelo is a good enough shooter. Lonzo, despite that release, you know, he hit more than 40% of his threes during his one season at UCLA, so it could work. Before we have the inevitable LaVar Ball conversation, Derek, you mentioned that Lonzo is the second best prospect in this draft in your mind. What offensively makes him so special?
You know, I think, first of all, he's one of the best transition players you're going to see. And that's at the college level, that's going to be at the NBA level. Like, he just, he has, first of all, he can force turnovers, and he's really good at that. But he, it's not even that he has elite vision, but he will get the ball out so quickly. And a lot of times, you'll see guards grab the ball and pound it, push. You know, if he has a guy leaking, he'll find him right away. He'll have an outlet pass like, you know, like one of the, some of the really elite big outlet passers. And he will do that, and he will push the ball. And he'll really incentivize his big men and his wings to run and fill lanes and reward them when they do so. So I think that's going to help a team quite a bit. But I also just think, you know, I do think he's going to be somewhat dependent on where he goes, because the concerns about being able to create his own offense in the half court are very real. Like, he just doesn't have that burst coming off a pick and roll. He doesn't have a whole lot of wiggle in his dribble. He doesn't change directions all that well. And I think he's going to struggle because of that. But I think when, you know, first of all, I think that shot is going to translate as funky as it does look. I mean, he made a lot of NBA three-point range attempts. He had a lot of difficult contested attempts. And I think that will help. But I think you're going to have to put him next to another guy who can really create at a high level. I think one of the interesting fits would be the Sixers and Ben Simmons. I do also think that, you know, having D'Angelo Russell there with the Lakers would help as well. But I do think there is some concern there. But when you can force a team, and you see this a little bit with Golden State, but when you can force a defense to, you know, to defend every pick and roll, every big man diving the hoop, to defend every, you know, wing cutting the basket, or every perimeter player running off of a screen 20 feet from the basket. When you have an elite passer like that who has that kind of vision, who can execute the passes, and, you know, who will reward guys cutting and rolling and diving and running off of screens, it really opens up an offense, because you're forcing them to defend every action. Nobody can take a second off. You can make all four of your guys real threats. And I just think he's one of the, you know, he really, it's kind of cliche to say it, and I hate doing it, but he really does think the game at an extremely high level. And he also doesn't dominate the ball. And I think, especially as more and more players go to the two-point guard sets, you mentioned it. There's never a time where I look at it and I go, man, he's an elite passer and a good shooter. We have too much of that.
Right.
Like, there's no duplication of those skills. That doesn't exist. What you really ask, you know, if you're looking at a point guard or a ball handler, can he shoot off the catch and help place, you know, basically provide value when he doesn't have the ball, and can he defend his position? And with Lonzo, he can shoot off the catch. He's a really good cutter. And, I mean, he, you know, we can talk about his athleticism, whether or not he can create off the dribble. But when he gets ahead of steam and he's going, you know, in a straight line forward, he can elevate around the rim, and he's a real lob threat. And he also sees those cutting lanes very well. So he has two very key characteristics that you'd want in an off-the-ball player. I think if you have another guy who can force a double team and force a defensive rotation, you know, he can then make those quick reads and those touch passes where if you, you know, kind of slide him up to the top of the key when, let's say, a Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid pick and roll is going on, just to bring it back to the Sixers because I cover them. You know, if you swing it back out to Lonzo at the top of the key, he can then find that wherever the defense is late in their rotation, make a quick decisive read and make the correct read. And I think he's going to provide a lot of value that way. I do think you're going to have, you know, two or three guys who are better scorers than him, better half-court initiators than him. But if you can get that, I think you can really unlock an elite potential, you know, an elite kind of role player offensive talent, and a guy who can make everyone on their team better.
Yeah, you know, I know this is stupid, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but I've been relatively out on Lonzo because of his dad more than anything else. You know, as for speaking solely for the Sixers, it was like, I do not want LeVar Ball and the Philadelphia media to ever interact, because that's just a snake pit that he would be, you know, awful in. But hearing your scouting report, especially with the Simmons and Embiid, you know, envisioning that, I'm back in on Lonzo. So if the Lakers pass him up, I'm more interested in Lonzo now.
I mean, look, his father's a pain in, I don't know what your cursing policy is, but his father's a pain in the you-know-what.
Yeah.
It's I'm not going to tell you otherwise. I will say, I haven't talked to any real team that is too concerned, at least not concerned enough where they would draft or not draft based on LeVar Ball.
Okay.
Like, certainly you don't want him making comments, but I think this is much more of a media thing, because I think there's a couple things. First of all, if you're a GM and you select Lonzo Ball and LeVar Ball's a pain, you're not getting fired for that. And whenever I talk about what will teams do, a lot of it boils down to what's going to get a GM fired,
right,
at the end of the day. Drafting Lonzo and LeVar being a pain isn't going to get you fired. Not drafting Lonzo because you're scared of LeVar and Lonzo turning a team around and becoming a star. That will get you fired. Mm. So I don't think there's a. I don't think many teams are going to pass on him for that reason. I also think, look, you talk about the impact Lonzo had at UCLA, and I think that's an important distinction. That team completely bought into Lonzo Ball. They bought into his personality. They bought into his style of play. That was a very cohesive locker room. And to a T, they will all tell you that they enjoyed playing with him. And I think that's something that kind of gets lost in this kind of locker room, how is this going to impact the locker room discussion? Mm-hmm. I think it's an important distinction. And also, LeVar Ball, you know, they set pretty strict guidelines of what they would tolerate from LeVar Ball and what they wouldn't tolerate. And for the most part, he followed that. And this is a guy who's going to be in L.A. He's got two more sons that he's bringing up. He's going to be wanting to, you know, really work on their high school career, get them into college, build a big baller brand, and really build the brand for each of those four people, his three sons and himself. He's not going to, you know, you're not going to see him, I don't think, traveling with the team, going on road games, really spending a whole lot of time, unless it's in L.A. because he's obviously there. But if let's say it's Philadelphia, you're not going to see him come up to Philadelphia and really be in the third row yelling at Brett Brown's ear. I just don't think that's going to happen. Are you going to have to live with one or two stupid comments a year from him? Yeah, probably. I don't think there's any way to deny that. But I think you can mitigate that.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the third row thing because I just immediately have flashbacks. I think it was Jahlil Okafor's rookie year where there was that report that Okafor's dad was kind of hanging close to the Sixers bench yelling at Brett Brown. And then I'm thinking, like, put Okafor's dad and LeVar Ball next to each other. God help the entire team. But yeah, that's really, I'm glad that you provided, I mean, that insight, A, that teams aren't really scared of him, because I've been wondering about that, you know, if it's going to affect his draft stock at all, or how much it will. But B, I mean, yeah, everything we hear about Lonzo is the polar opposite of that we hear, that we see with LeVar. You know, he seems like he's just a quiet, hardworking kid, like is not going to go out of his way to be brash. It did seem like teammates liked him, and, you know, every comment I see from a teammate of his is like, yeah, this kid's really good. You know, he's going to be really good at basketball. So it's really interesting. Let's go to the Sixers now at number three. You released a big board, I believe, earlier this week, Sixers-centric big board. And I'm really interested because at number three, you know, I feel like the consensus, whatever consensus there is at this point, the consensus is that Josh Jackson is the third best prospect in this draft. You have Jonathan Isaac as the third ranked player on your Sixers big board. So tell me why you have Isaac above Jackson.
Yeah, well, first of all, kind of the way I would describe Isaac, and I called it quote-unquote hitting a double. And offensively, I think that's probably his upside. Like, I don't see a whole lot of really shot creator in Jonathan Isaac. I don't think you're going to run much of your offense through him. I think what he can provide offensively is, you know, of the kind of wing prospects, the forward prospects, the Isaacs, Jackson, and Tatum, I have the most confidence in his jump shot. I think his release is the cleanest and the most repeatable. And I think that's a huge deal when you're talking about spacing the floor, especially for Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid. Mm-hmm. But I think his defensive potential, I think he has home run defensive potential. So I think I look at some of these guys and I question, first of all, I think the Sixers are in a slightly different spot than most teams, because a lot of times when you're in the top of the draft, you don't really have kind of your focal points figured out yet. That you're still working through that process. And usually when you draft your focal points, you end up improving, even if it's only to maybe 7, 8, 9 spot in the draft, but you kind of improve out of this range of the draft. But because Joel Embiid only played 31 games, because Ben Simmons missed his entire rookie year, the Sixers kind of lost the games, even though they have that kind of elite talent already on the roster. And certainly you can't go banking on Joel Embiid's health. You can't go really counting on Ben Simmons being an elite prospect yet until he does something in the NBA. But you do have, I mean, Joel Embiid is going to be one of the most dynamic players in this league if he's healthy. And Ben Simmons is someone they've already committed to as running a lot of their half-court offense through. So I think you have to give a little bit of extra credence to how do they fit with the guys we already have, because the guys we already have are more likely to be your focal points than whoever you draft at three. So I think having that confidence in Isaac's shot, knowing that I think, or not knowing, but again, having confidence, I think he can space the floor. The fact that he moves and cuts well off the ball, the fact that he can force turnovers and even handle the ball a little bit in transition, I just think that all matches up very well with what the Sixers need. And defensively, I mean, look, he's 6'11". He can move his feet like a two guard. He's got a huge standing reach. If you look at his numbers in terms of rebounds and blocks and steals, he was an absolutely elite, productive defensive player. And also, he has that kind of versatility. I think when you watch these finals and you look at Golden State and the fact that they can pretty much switch any position, that's a huge benefit. It simplifies your defensive responsibilities. It puts you less likely to really have a 4-on-3 on the back end for the other team. And I think being able to do that at a consistent level is a real game changer defensively. And I think if you have Isaac and Ben Simmons and Robert Covington with Joel Embiid behind it, I really like that kind of foundation that you could have defensively. So part of it is fit with the Simmons. I'm not sure I'd have him 3 on my kind of league-wide big board. And part of it is the fact that I trust his jump shot a little bit more. And even if he doesn't have necessarily the mindset to be a number one or a number two option, that's almost a benefit for the Sixers, where he would be the third and hopefully eventually fourth option anyway. So I like him for the Sixers. I like his defensive potential for pretty much anyone. And also part of it is that I'm just not, if I look at the guys I think are going to be real focal points, the guys that could really develop into primary initiators on a perimeter, I don't have as much confidence as some people do in Josh Jackson and De'Aaron Fox. So part of it is that as well.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm sold on Isaac, honestly. I mean, Morton, you can attest to this. We recorded the day after the lottery, and at first I'm excited because the Sixers, getting the third pick is great. Getting it as part of the pick swap is even better, the sake of hilarity. But then I sat down and I'm like, I don't love any of the options at 3. Like, I don't know what they do here. So let's say they do fall in love with Jonathan Isaac and he is the third ranked prospect on their board. Would you, if you're the Sixers, would you then try to trade down to get additional assets and still hope, say you can get him at 5 from Sacramento or 6 from Orlando? Would you try to trade down so you can get something else in addition to him, or would you just stand pat at 3 and just grab him?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say because the what is very important there. Mm-hmm. Like, certainly if you can get another good asset, I have a pretty reasonable degree of confidence that he would be available at 5 or 6, and yeah. But if it's, if we're talking like a second round pick, then no, just take the guy that you have confidence in. Remove as many unknowns as you can in terms of what other teams will do, or maybe even what other teams trading up might be willing to do. So it's hard to say because it's such an unknown in what you'd be getting back. But yeah, I think this is a kind of situation, because the guys I do kind of like at 3 could be available at 5 or 6, I would have a lot of interest in trading down. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's turn to the other side of that coin for a second, because you floated this on Twitter, and Morton, I want to ask you this to get the the unbiased view, because we're both coming from it from a Sixers perspective. So Derek, this is not a sourced thing. We're making that clear right away. This is just pure speculation. But let's say Boston's shopping the number one pick, Morton. If you're Boston, would you trade the number one pick for Philly's number 3, the Lakers pick, which is completely unprotected next year, and Dario Saric?
Oh, that's a tough one. Now, I am so in love with Markelle Fultz, I probably wouldn't.
Mm.
That's my gut there, because when I look at Markelle Fultz, I see a Dwayne Wade with range.
Mm-hmm.
That's the type of guy I think he can develop into. So I think that kind of upside, that's kind of superstar level potential, is just too intriguing. Dario is he's amazing. He's one of those guys who can really play make at the 4, which we know is a huge thing in the current climate of the NBA. So that's obviously very attractive. But as you alluded to as well, like the number 3 slot, there are not a whole bunch of guys. There's like the drop down after the whole Fultz and Lonzo Ball thing. So afterwards, you have the Josh Jackson, the Tatums, the Isaacs, and they are that tier below, that which makes the whole package just less intriguing. So I'm going to stick with my gut and say, no, I'm probably going to need a little bit more if I'm Boston.
Interesting. See, I mean, Derek, you and I both would do that from the Sixers side, but I was talking with a couple other Sixers guys who run NBA assets with me, and they thought that was too much for the Sixers. They were like, hell no, we're not going to trade that much. In a sense, that might mean it's actually a fair offer if both sides aren't in love with it. That's usually the sign that, you're at least in the range of it being reasonable. But it's real. It's interesting. I feel like the Lakers, you know, they could change the draft if they don't take Lonzo at two, but assuming they do, the Sixers are the real kind of linchpin for the draft, because they can go, they could take a random guy at three, you know, or take Josh Jackson, take Jonathan Isaac, who would be, you know, at least send mock drafts just completely into oblivion if they do that. They could trade down, they could try trading up. Like, there are a lot of different options the Sixers have, which makes them really fascinating for the next couple weeks. So apologies in advance, listeners. You're going to be hearing a lot more about the Sixers between now and June 22nd. Derek, you mentioned, you know, Josh Jackson and De'Aaron Fox. The big issues with them are their shot. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, what you're seeing with that, how confident you are that, you know, those guys will be able to overcome that? And if they don't, do their other pluses outweigh the potential that, you know, they're never consistent three-point shooters?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're both very big concerns. And I mean, Jackson, I think he ended up shooting like 38% from three, mostly through a late season surge on a pretty low sample size, which is backed up by pretty much no other indicator I could find. You look at his high school results, they were, you know, he shot poorly from high school from three and from the line. You look at his free throw percentage, he shot mid-50s. You look at the form on his jump shot, and it's just, to me, it's a mess and an unrepeatable mess, and that's the biggest concern. Mm-hmm. I can deal with messes of a jump shot if it's consistent, but I don't think his is. And all of those, to me, kind of suggest that in that late season surge he had, that three-point percentage, I don't have a whole lot of confidence in it carrying over. To me, it's a lot like Justice Winslow a couple of years ago, where he's playing the four, he's getting a lot of space because of that, and he had kind of a late season surge on a low sample to make his percentage look really good. I think that jump shot is a huge concern. The hitch in the middle, the out front release, the footwork, I think all of it is pretty concerning to me. And without that, you know, for the longest time I had Jackson as a second rated prospect in this draft for me. And a lot of that is from his all around game, which I think is mostly still there. Like, I think he's a good defender. He doesn't quite have that elite profile of a guy like Isaac, but he probably has realized more of his potential right now defensively. He's, you know, just an active, in your face kind of defender. And he does have good athleticism. He moves his feet well, and he competes. And that's gonna, you know, that's gonna go a long way in this league. He does pass the ball well. I don't think it's quite to the point of being a primary initiator. He does also have good ball handling. He can take you off the dribble. Again, I don't think it's quite. I think some people look at him as a future high level scorer on the wing. I'm not sure I quite see that. But he does everything other than shooting at a level where he can contribute. And I think if he could shoot, and I have confidence he could shoot, I think it would make a really good third option on a team. And maybe if he improves more than maybe the median curve, could end up being a little bit more than that. But I think so much of that, of what he does do, is dependent on that shot. Like, it's really hard to be a creator from the perimeter, from the wing, if you can't shoot. And if teams don't have to, you know, respect you out of the three-point line to open up, you know, an ability to attack a closeout, or if teams don't have to respect you coming off a pick and roll, it's a lot harder to do that in the NBA. And if you're going to ask me whether he's going to be kind of that inflection point is like a 32%, 33% three-point shooter. If you're asking me if he's going to be a consistent 33% three-point shooter, I'm just not sure I'm quite there yet. And I think that soured me a little bit. And look, I didn't drop him too far. I think I still had him top five, because if he does improve more than I expect, the rest of the game is there where he can be a, you know, a real nice piece for somebody. But I have quite a bit of confidence in that shot, and it's very important.
Yeah, I on your Sixers big board, you still have him four, so it's not. Yeah, again, yeah. It's not like you're dropping him, you know, to the mid teens or even outside the first round. You're still saying he is an elite prospect. But I mean, yeah, that is.
I would definitely take him with a first round.
Breaking news. Yeah. I mean, that's the concern, especially from the Sixers' perspective at three, because as you mentioned, you know, you need shooters alongside Simmons and Embiid. So if that shot doesn't come around, yeah, they're going to be defensively very tenacious. But we've seen, you know, earlier in the year when Robert Covington like forgot how to shoot for a month, he was still, you know, an amazing defender. But the rotations don't work as well if you don't have that shooter alongside Embiid. So it's definitely a concern for Jackson. Let's go to the other top guard prospects in this draft, namely Dennis Smith Jr. and Malik Monk. You have them 5 and 6 on your Sixers big board. Talk to us about what you like out of both of those guys.
Yeah, and I think both of those are a little bit higher on my Sixers big board than they would be on my league-wide because of, I mean, again, so much about fit with Simmons and Embiid. You know, with Dennis Smith Jr., there's just, when I look at it from a Sixers perspective, there are very few guys with really high upside and both potential fit, and he's one of those guys that checks both of those boxes. You know, he, in terms of an athlete, you're not going to find really any better guard athlete in this draft, or at least not with his kind of skill level. And the fact that he can come off a pick and roll and burn you from three-point range, from mid-range, at the rim, he really can elevate around the rim. And I also think his passing is a little bit underrated as well. Maybe not his decision-making, but his court vision and whatnot. You know, there's some risk there. There's some risk with his defense, which he didn't play at all at NC State last year. There's some risk with his decision-making, and there's a risk anytime you take a 6'1 guard and put him in the NBA, and I think he kind of has a frame to overcome that, but there's still a risk factor there. But if I'm looking at it from the Sixers' perspective, like I said, the fact that he has both high upside and if he works out, he can fit, because I do think, in terms of his jump shot, I think he shot better than I expected coming in, and he certainly shot better off the catch, and that's a really big one with Simmons and Embiid, and working with another primary initiator in Simmons. There was a little inconsistency off the dribble, and I think he's going to have to shore that up. But when I look at what he was able to do, and if there's one player, and you could put Fultz in this group too, but if there's one player who his teammates really did nothing for him, it was Dennis Smith at NC State. And it's not even, you know, when he steps onto an NBA court and he has a 7'2" guy shooting from the three-point line, like, his world's just going to open up. It's going to be a completely different game for him, because you watch him, his big men had no idea how to play off him. They couldn't space the floor. And there was constantly two or three other people in the paint when he was trying to drive through the lane. So I think he could really be helped by, you know, the rules in the NBA, the spacing in the NBA, the further three-point line, the emphasis on big men shooting, because NC State was kind of a mess in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, that it sounds like, I honestly didn't see much of NC State during the year, but now, you know, going back and starting to envision all these guys on the Sixers, it does seem like it seems like Sixers Twitter especially has fallen kind of head over heels for him, especially Spike Eskin. I think it was like number two on Spike's YouTube big board, which, you know,
which is always a well-researched board,
right? Yes,
always, yeah.
Relying solely on YouTube highlights. But yeah, I mean, it does seem like everything I saw of Smith, you know, I've seen people make the comparison to Russell Westbrook, which I don't know if I'm quite there, but, you know, his athleticism does remind me in that mold, at least. I mean, again, if he's a guy that I don't know if I'm the Sixers, if I take him at three, but if I could trade down and get him at five or six, I'm ecstatic about that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, he has one of the higher variances in the draft. Like, I could see him where he could be a really dynamic player, and I could see him where he eventually gets moved out of the starting lineup. Like, I can see both outcomes, and I'm not sure which is necessarily more likely, but I am a little bit more willing to gamble on that pick because, like I said, I don't see that combination of fit and upside for the Sixers at that
right
spot.
Exactly. So let's talk about Monk quickly as well, because, you know, the upside is obvious. He's possibly the best quote-unquote scorer in the draft. I mean, you know, he goes off for 45 when he gets hot. The concern obviously is that he's 6'3", and, you know, that's very undersized for a two guard. So do you think, is he going to have to transition to point guard? And is he capable of doing that? Or if he stays at two guard, does he stand a chance on either end of the floor?
Well, so as a shot creator, I think he might have slightly more potential in the NBA than he did in college. And in part, you know, just because of the spacing of the NBA, when people close out on him, he's going to have driving lanes open up. And I don't think he has really good court vision, but I do think he is good enough where he can at least kind of make an almost predetermined read, which, again, when you blow by your guy because he closes out too aggressively and you have those kind of easy kick-out passes available to you, I think he can execute those. But if you're asking me, can he, you know, can you give him, ask him to bring the ball up and really initiate an offense, run a pick-and-roll from the top, and get guys into their sets, I'm not sure I see that kind of level of creativity or even that real instinct to do so. So, no, I think he's best as a, you know, as kind of an off-ball kind of guy. but defensively is a really big concern. And, you know, I think he can move his feet laterally a little bit. I don't think that's where he's going to have the biggest problems. The biggest problems are going to come as a defender in the pick and roll and against guys who are quite simply just way bigger than him. And at the two spot, I think that's going to be quite a big challenge. And it's part of the reason why he's higher on my Sixers big board than he is on my league-wide, because Ben Simmons is so unique in the fact that he's going to initiate at least a good portion of your offense from, you know, the small forward, power forward spot. You can have Malik Monk be the shortest player on your, you know, on the court for you, and not ask him to initiate much of that offense. So I think he's gonna have to kind of go to the right spot. But certainly when you have that kind of shooting, and look, shooting is sometimes one of the tougher skills to really translate. And the fact that he's 6'3", you know, if he has 6'7" guys with NBA length and speed closing out on him, it might be a half second here or there might be the difference between a shot that goes in and a shot that doesn't at a high rate. But I do think the fact that he elevates so well on his jump shot and he gets it out so quickly, I think he'll be able to overcome that. But there is always a slight concern about whether or not a shot is going to translate. And for him, it really has to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting to hear that you have him. You have him sixth on your Sixers big board. So I'm guessing he's like around eighth or so on your league-wide.
Yeah, probably. I haven't actually fleshed it out. This first year, I haven't. You know, I kind of do a lot for Draft Express, but in the past I had done mock drafts and big boards for USA Today, and I'm not doing that this year because I'm focusing a little bit more on writing about the Sixers full-time. So I don't know if I have it quite fleshed out, but yeah, it would probably be somewhere in that range.
7 to 8 range? Okay, cool. So you have, let's go down a little bit further. You had De'Aaron Fox on your Sixers big board. You have him 7th. You have Jason Tatum 8th.
Yep.
Talk to us about what you like out of Tatum, then also what worries you from him.
Well, I mean, I think Tatum has a very high skill level, and you look at him and his footwork and the diversity of moves he has is very good. And certainly there are questions about his athleticism, and I share those concerns. But I think there's a pretty reasonable chance that he's going to at least be a contributor and kind of like a solid starter type guy, with upside to be a little more than that if he can, you know, kind of continue to expand his game, specifically to the NBA three-point line, to overcome that. My concern with the Sixers is I think he's pretty locked in as a defender. I think he's going to be best at the four. Maybe at times you can get away with him at the three, but certainly not any more than that. And when I look at guys like Isaac and Jackson, and I think they can all legitimately defend three spots. So I think that versatility is big, especially because you know, you have Ben Simmons on the roster. You have Dario Saric on the roster. And both of them, you know, I think Simmons is capable of at times defending the three, but I would prefer him really defending the four and being in position for rebounds and being able to push the ball in transition. I think that's his best spot. So when you have two guys already on the roster where their best spot is a power forward defender, I'm not sure how much interest I have, unless I really thought Jason Tatum was going to be a 20-plus point per game scorer and a real focal point. And I'm not sure I quite see that. I think he's going to be good, but I'm not sure he's going to be good enough to really overcome that glut you already kind of have at the 4-5 for the Sixers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Also, we have a Duke guy already that we had a bad experience with. So I'm out on Duke players for a while. We need to just clear the roster of those before we could take any more. He also, I mean, doesn't it seem like he's definitely just going to end up in Orlando and they're going to force Aaron Gordon back to the three, and it's just going to be like a never-ending cycle of putting Aaron Gordon out of position?
Yeah, it's
fated to happen.
Aaron Gordon's career has made me slightly sad. In part because I still have no idea what he can be because he's been so out of position.
Right, yeah. Morton and I both, I mean, we've been pretty merciless about the Magic for quite some time. So who knows? Now with this new management, maybe, you know, it's the Milwaukee guys who hit on Giannis and they hit on a bunch of the reaches, quote-unquote, at the draft. So maybe they surprise us all and take someone who's not being mentioned in that number six range and say screw it, we actually want to play Aaron Gordon in position. But right. Yeah, we'll see what happens with Tatum. So can you talk just briefly about some of the late lottery or mid first round guys that have your eye? I know Morton, I said you're not a Bulls fan, but assuming you make up with them between now and the draft, the Bulls are 16 on the board, so maybe some guys that the Bulls should have their eye on.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think the end of the lottery, I think there's a couple of really good defensive prospects. And Frank Ntilikina, Donovan Mitchell, and OG Anunoby. Like, I like all three of those as potential, you know, versatile defensive guys. And I think, you know, Mitchell doesn't necessarily check that box that you would typically think of because he's only, you know, only like 6'3", but he has a huge wingspan. I think he's really going to be able to guard either guard position. And Ntilikina and Anunoby are just, I mean, they're freaks physically. And I think OG Anunoby, along with Isaac, might have the most defensive versatility in the draft. So I think those are guys I kind of have my eye on in the late lottery. I like Ike Anagbogu because of just what he could be in terms of his body and his athleticism. He really doesn't have a whole lot of skill level now, but I think, you know, there's something to at least build upon. And then you just get into this power forward center portion of the draft that I'm just not really in love with. Like, I think kind of that 15 through 30 range, if I had to pick a weak spot in this draft, I think that's kind of it, because there's just, I mean, it's a lot of big guys who don't have a whole lot of intrigue for me. And it's, you know, with the exception of Jonathan Jean, I think he could be kind of interesting of separating himself from that group just because of how much being able to cover ground is a priority in today's NBA. So I think there's, you know, then some depth later on in the second round, and that's stupid to say because if the second round was so great, then they would be, you know, first rounders. But I think what I'm saying is that the tail off from 15 to 30 and then from 30 to 45 maybe isn't as severe of a tail off as it typically is. But yeah, I mean, there's still, you know, there's still exactly where a guy like Harry Giles is going to go, because I don't think we have any real idea how much he can come back from all those injuries. I think that will be interesting to watch. I'm not sure exactly where I would want to be that guy who would take that gamble on him, and how high I would want to take that gamble on him. But knowing what I saw in high school and the kind of dynamic athlete I saw there, it'll be interesting to see, you know, kind of follow his career and see how much he can get back into what he was.
Yeah, I've seen a couple mocks put him to Miami at 14, and that actually seems like a really interesting spot for him, because I feel like if you're putting him on a team where you're asking him to be the number one option right away, you're setting yourself up for disappointment. But, you know, if Miami still has Goran Dragic, they still have Whiteside, let's say they bring Deion Waiters back, they can kind of, like, ease Harry into, you know, into the NBA life and hope that his knees can hold up. So yeah, he's definitely, would you say it's fair to call him like the biggest high variance pick in that range?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's so much of it is regaining that mobility and athleticism. He looked like a stiff big man, and not like stiff untalented, but like his hips weren't as fluid. He didn't get out of his breaks nearly as quickly as he did when he was in high school. It's yeah, I mean, if he recovers, he can still be, you know, really be a player in this league. I'm just not sure how much confidence I have in that happening.
Right, yeah. I'm also glad you mentioned OG, because I've wanted him for so long. It's like my dream is that the Sixers somehow could pry 5 and 10 away from Sacramento and then take, you know, whoever at 5 and get OG at 10 and just... You know, they're used to having guys miss their whole rookie season anyway, so that's fine. That's totally, we don't mind that.
But I'm glad you made the injury joke, because I was going there too.
Yeah, right, we have to. But at the same time, I then don't want him to come to the Sixers, because I want him to get good medical care and maybe preserve his career and not play with a torn meniscus. Mort, are there any guys in that range that you would like to ask Derek about?
Oh, John Collins, because I am so intrigued about Collins. I know that he's not a strong defender and that he doesn't have a whole bunch of range, but the fact that he's so young and just completed his sophomore season, and am I wrong in feeling that people are kind of sleeping on him? He is so productive.
Yes, I would have him in the late lottery area, for sure. And I think playing for Wake, it's probably a little tough to maybe get the recognition he should have deserved, even though you're playing in the ACC. Not one of the flashier programs, but yes, I think he, in terms of body type and fluidity and movement, I think he should probably be ranked a little bit higher. And look, he was, like you said, he was extremely productive despite playing his entire sophomore season at 19 years old. He, to me, is a little bit underrated as a prospect, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Anyone else for it?
Well, I'm kind of looking down the Draft Express list, and the one guy that sticks out to me is a big unknown, is Terrence Ferguson, since he was in Australia last year. There is not a whole lot of film on him. Like, I've been going into draft mode lately, and that's one of those guys that I'm just so frustrated with because I can't find a lot of footage on him. So, Derek, how much insight do you have in Ferguson?
Well, not only did he play in, you know, did he play overseas in Australia, but he also didn't play big minutes over there. You know, that's a professional league where they had some depth there. I think he played like 15 minutes a night. He is, first of all, he's long. He can move his feet really well, and that's kind of the basis of his defensive profile. And I think he's going to, you know, I think that's going to get some interest around in the league because of that. He also improved his outside shot. You know, he shot fairly well, not great, but I think he showed the ability to make shots last year in Australia. And I think that, you know, teams are so enamored with potential 3-and-D type prospects that I think that's going to keep him pretty high, relatively high at least in the draft. I think it's going to keep him in the 20s in the first round range. The question is really utilizing that. You know, he's rail thin. I mean, tiny. He really needs to develop his core and upper body strength. And I think that's going to be, he doesn't look to me like he has a kind of physical profile where that's kind of a foregone conclusion. You know, you look at a lot of these guys, and once they get in the NBA, they hit that 19, 20, 21 year old range where you really can add muscle, and you put them in an NBA program, and a lot of people do. I mean, their bodies change pretty drastically, but I think he has a kind of body type where you kind of wonder about that. And he also doesn't necessarily play with the, I won't say the highest motor, but in terms of, you could tell that he doesn't have the physicality to really compete in a pro league like he was in Australia. And you worry how much he's going to be able to contribute in the NBA because of that. And that affects him as a finisher, that affects him as a rebounder, and as a defender as well. And I think that's going to be his three biggest things, improving his ball handling, becoming a more consistent shooter, even though he's shown that he can make the shot, and really finishing out his body and being a little bit more physical of a player. And you kind of hope that that kind of mentality clicks when he has a body to compete physically, but again, even that doesn't always happen. So there are some concerns, but in a league that is fascinated by potential 3-and-D guys, I think he's going to draw some interest.
So a less motivated Will Barton? In terms of body, he seems somewhat similar.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I'd necessarily say motivated. It just seems like he can shy away from contact a little bit.
Oh,
I guess
okay.
Is what I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, Draft Express has him 25 right now going to the Magic. So if the Sixers could trade 6 of 25 for 3, Terrence Ferguson could be a Sixer. Okay, Derek, are there any late first-round guys or second-round sleepers that you think should be getting more attention?
You know, I like Juwan Evans. From Oklahoma State.
Yeah.
You know, I think he has a kind of body type and really people love to talk about three-level scores, but I think he can do a lot. The way he improved over the course of his career, and you know, sometimes you got to worry about, I don't want to say late bloomers because he's not that old, but a lot of times when those that shot really translates later on, you worry about that a little bit. But I trust his shot. I trust his, you know, ability to kind of get into paint. I think he's a pretty good passer. Like I said, I think he's just a good all-around player. I like him. When you're talking about him as a potential second-round pick, I like him quite a bit. Jordan Bell from Oregon, I like a little bit. There's a couple more kind of wing players later on in the draft. Local guy Josh Hart, PJ Dozier, I like. There's some depth in this draft. Like I said, once I think you get kind of past that center heavy portion in the middle, I think there's some potential finds on the wings later on.
Yeah, I mean, and the worth noting, the Sixers have 4 second round picks.
Yes.
It's pretty safe to say they won't be using all 4 on stateside prospects. You got to figure at least 1 or 2 of them are going to be draft and stash guys. They could always package 2 or 3 and trade up. So,
well, they have 5 potential lottery picks in the next 3 drafts, and then they have 4 second round picks in this draft. So yes. Odds are they're probably not going to keep all of them.
Right. I think Brian Colangelo has already basically said, my phone is open, so start calling me, GMs. Right. But, you know, the deals don't tend to go down until close to the draft, so we'll have a couple more weeks to speculate about guys who will probably not be on the board once once they actually get on the board.
Right.
Mort, do you have any final questions for Derek?
One, and that's Caleb Swanigan. when you look at him, 20 years old, 18 points a game, 12 rebounds. Also, another guy highly productive, all the way down on 40th on Draft Express. What am I missing about Caleb?
Yeah, I mean, he's... You're kind of asking me to play devil's advocate because I do like him as well. So I'm not sure I can necessarily play devil's advocate because the way his shot improved, like I said, and again, sometimes you kind of look at those guys and he's not that old. He just turned 20. But the way his shot improved from his freshman to his sophomore year, I do think I kind of agree with you that he should maybe be getting a little bit more, a little bit more attention than he should. Mm. I think there's a lot of concerns about him defensively. And whether or not that's going to translate to the NBA. Certainly when you start drafting some of those big guys who don't really project as a rim protector at all, that makes it a little bit more difficult. But again, in a league that's obsessed with spacing and what he can potentially do if that shot is pure and if that shot is a legitimate improvement, to me, he's a reasonable gamble in the second round. I would probably have him a little bit higher. But I think some of those defensive concerns are probably what's keeping him back from being like a first-round talent.
Yeah, because when I saw him play, I mean, it seemed like he had pretty good playmaking abilities. Like, he was a good passer.
Yeah, he does.
So
he does. But, I mean, he has kind of like that bad combination where he doesn't protect the rim. Mm. You can put him in a pick and roll and kind of take advantage of him in space. And he's not really a great rotational defender. I mean, it's really when we're talking about why some teams might have him lower. It's because of that side of the court.
Oh, okay.
But again, if that shot is pure, then you can always find room for a stretch forward.
Yeah.
Morton, if you wanted Jahlil Okafor, you could just have him. I'm pretty sure we would trade him for anyone on your roster right now.
Just Denzel about Valentine. Anyone, yeah.
Well, if Jahlil Okafor began shooting 44.7% from downtown like Caleb, I would.
Yeah, that would be dare to dream.
And I'm not sure what my roster is, Brian. I like the fact that you keep playing a matchmaker. It's over, Brian. Yeah. You need to acknowledge it.
I think Okafor has made a three.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Has he?
One for six. There you go. What more can you ask for?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm sold.
He's the next Karl Anthony Towns.
Well, Gar Foreman is sold. He'll not only send you the best player in the deal, he'll also send you a draft pick because that's how he rolls. You know?
Well, look, I saw your point guard rotation. Shooting is clearly not high at on the priority list.
You aren't sold on Michael Carter Williams as a prospect anymore?
Oh, and they gave up Tony Snell.
I was yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
When you Tony lose Snell. A Tony Snell right. deal, that's when you know what's up, right?
Right. Derek, any final takeaways about this draft class as a whole that people should be thinking about, you know, in the weeks leading up to the draft?
You know, I think the top of the draft and the volatility, not necessarily in the players, but in the teams, when you look at Boston, and, you know, we talked about earlier, I wouldn't trade the pick if I was Danny Ainge, but I'm not Danny Ainge, and he probably has a lot more interest in it than I do because of how close they've been of late and trying to get over that hump. But when you have teams that can move the pick, like Boston, like the Sixers potentially could, it really sets up a draft that could just be completely unpredictable. And I think that's kind of what we have here. And like you said, nothing really happens until we get closer to the draft, so don't expect anything in the next week or two. But I think that, you know, the day or two leading up to the draft could be really fun to watch league-wide.
Yeah, and we should, I mean, also worth noting, a lot of teams in the 20s have multiple picks, you know, Portland has three, and Sporting News, Sean Devaney reported yesterday that they're shopping one or more of those picks to get out from the plethora of bad contracts they signed last summer. Orlando has two.
It's going to take more than a pick around 20 to give me Evan Turner's contract. Sorry.
Oh, my God. If Brian Colangelo trades for Evan Turner, I'm like you. We'll be NBA vagabonds. We're going to need to find a new team. But yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's going to be some fireworks. You know, Carmelo Anthony has been dangled for months now. So who knows? I think Ian Begley of ESPN reported that the Knicks were in on those Portland talks. So who knows if that turns into something?
It should.
But yeah,
they kind of need to, because you have a Kristaps Porzingis right there who needs young available assets to grow alongside him. So if that means taking on Evan Turner, like, the Knicks aren't going anywhere, in you know, a couple of years anyway, so why not? And then, of course, like Derek said, it shouldn't be the 20th. It should probably be, like, the 15th.
Right, yeah. Right. Or, yeah, 20th and 26th or whatever they right. have. So, I mean,
you can get talent.
There's a lot of... Yeah, and, you know, the...
What's probably more realistic, though, is probably a guy like Mo Harkless. Like, I'll take on Mo Harkless's contract long before I'm taking on Evan
Turner. Oh, absolutely.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think... I forget if Ian Begley or Sean Devaney reported this, but they floated Myers Leonard out there as well as another guy they were trying to get rid of. And then Alan Crabb, too, who, you know, the Nets have been interested. They were the ones who drove the price up on him last summer, so we know they're interested. I think he does have a trade kicker on his contract, which will make that even more expensive. But, again, you know, the Nets, like the Knicks, aren't going anywhere. They need to acquire young talent however they can. So keep an eye out for that over the coming weeks. That will be something to track if the finals continue to be as uncompetitive as they are. Derek, thanks again for joining us. We really appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. Anytime.
And again, just remind our listeners where they can find your work.
At Derek Bodner, NBA.
Great. Yeah, so follow him on Twitter. Check out, he's got, for Sixers fans, if you're not already following him, you should be. He's got his own website dedicated to Sixers coverage. He's also on Draft Express. So check him out
and
on
Patreon.
Twitter. And Patreon, yeah. He's got, right, yes, we should totally plug that, yeah.
I beg for money, yeah.
Yes. It worked. Weren't you, like, held up as one of the examples of Patreon recently?
Yeah, I was actually not on, but I was a subject of a TED Talk, which was pretty crazy. It's been going well so far, yeah.
Yeah, so everyone, even if you're not a Sixers fan, it's $3 a month, right, Derek?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, so $3 a month gets you a lot more of Derek's work, well worth the price. So check him out on Twitter. And again, thank you all for joining us. You can find us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find all of our Twitter handles in there as well. I should have mentioned at the top of the hour, but our normal third co-host, Sarah Chilea, could not join us today. She will be back next time, hopefully. She has a thing called a job, which is just foreign to all of us, but she will be back there. You can find us on iTunes, so check us out there, leave some feedback, subscribe and download as well. And then we are being hosted this year on FanRag Sports, so check them out on Twitter at FanRag Sports. And for their NBA content at FanRag NBA. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined by Morten Jensen and Derek Bodner. Have a good one, you two.
Likewise, Brian.
You too.